Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio, brought to you by the OU Israel Center in Jerusalem. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky. The show is being recorded on Yom Chamishi B'Shabbat Parshat Devarim, Shabbat Chazon, Shabbat Erev Tisha B'Av. It's Thursday, August 11th. It is the 6th of the month of Av. This Shabbat is, we read Devarim, which is always the Shabbat before Tisha B'Av. The Shabbat is known as Shabbat Chazon, based on the first word in the Haftorah, Chazon Yeshayahu, first chapter of Yeshayahu, a very depressing prophecy, and only the final two psukim have a positive note of the Geula, the redemption of the future. This particular Shabbat Chazon happens to be Erev Tisha B'Av, and that gives a very distinct nature to the day. We'll talk about that quite a lot in moments to come. And I would like to begin with not just Tehillim Kuf Lamed, Psalm 130, but I would like to add a psalm or two to that. I don't know how most of the listeners conduct themselves when I read this Tehillim. I want you to know, I've said it in the past, that I don't pre-record this particular segment, even though the reading of the Tehillim is always the same, but I read it each time so that it would not just be a piece of canned show, but it will be a tefillah, a prayer to God to please hear our prayers from the depths, from the dire straits. And that has a double meaning now, because, or triple meaning, it's the definition or sort of a connotation of Shir HaMalot Mima'amakim Kratiha Hashem. We're in the 3-week period of mourning from Shivasa B'Tammuz until Tisha B'Av, and that's known as Bein HaMitzarim, between the straits, in the straits. And not just historically, but what's going on with the impending implementation of the disengagement plan, which people are still prayerful and hopeful will not have to take place. We'll talk about that as well. But it's a very heavy, serious time, and we'll start with our usual Tehillim, but add one or two more. And I hope that listeners say it along with me, so that it will add to the power of prayer. Anyone who was at the Kotel or the Old City or tried to get to the Kotel last night can get a sense of the enormity and the power of prayer, especially when it is done with a large multitude of people. Shir HaMa'alot Mima'amakim Kraticha Adonai. Adonai Shema V'Koli Tihiena Aznecha Kashivot L'Kol Tachanunai. Im Avonot Tishmorya Adonai Mi Ya'amod. Ki Imacha Haslicha L'Ma'an Tivarei. Ki Viti Adonai Kiveta Nafshi V'Lidvaro Hocholti. Nafshi L'Adonai Mi Shomerim L'Boker Shomerim L'Boker. Yachel Yisrael El Adonai Ki Im Adonai HaChesed V'Harbe Imo Fedut. Vehu yifde et Yisrael mikol avonotav. Psalm 120, Tehillim Kuf Chaf. Shir HaMa'alot El Adonai Batsaratali Karati Vayaaneni. Adonai Hatzila Nafshi Misfat Sheker Milashon Remiya. Mayitain Lacha Umayosif Lach Lashon Remiya. Chitzei Gibor Shenunim Im gachalei retamim. Oyali ki garti meshech, shachanti im ohalei kedar. Rabat shachnala nafshi im sone shalom. Ani shalom v'chi adaber, hema lamilchama. And the next one as well, Kuf Kaf Aleph, Psalm 121. Shir lama'alot esa einai el heharim, Me'ayin yavo Ezri. Ezri me'im Adonai, Osei shamayim va'oretz. Al yitain lamot raglecha, al yanum shomerecha. Hine lo yanum velo yishan shomer Yisrael. Adonai shomrecha, Adonai tzilcha al yad yaminecha. Yomam hashemesh lo yakeka v'yoreach baloyla. Adonai yishmorcha mikolra, yishmor et nafshecha. Adonai yishmor tseisecha uvoecha me'ata v'yad olam. This last one, 121, is the famous Shir Lama'alot, I lift my eyes to the mountains, from where will come my salvation. My help, my salvation, is from God, the one who makes heaven and earth. And the last verse, God will preserve my going and coming, or your going and your coming, from now and always. Without going into more detail of the translation, those who are interested and don't know the Hebrew should look up Psalm 130, 120, and 121. Those are the three that I read. And now we read that summary prayer, which comes from the daily prayer service in the morning on days of Torah reading. Achenu kol beit Yisrael, hanetunim batzara uvashivya, ha'omedim bein bayam uvein bayabasha, ha'makom yurachem aleihem, v'yotzieim mitzara lirvacha, u'me'afela la'ora, u'mishibud la'gu'ula, hashta ba'agala uvizman kariv, v'nomar amen. Most often when there is a calendar date of interest, I would speak a little bit about the weekly Torah reading and a little bit about the particular calendar event, and most often they don't relate to each other. They are two cycles, the cycle of the Torah readings throughout the year and the cycle of the calendar of the holidays, and they don't always match up. Most often they do not. In the case of this week's Torah reading of Devarim, there cannot really be a better portion to read on the Shabbat right before Tisha B'Av. It has to have been done on purpose in some way. Let me ease into the situation. The book of Devarim takes place in one location, which is clearly set down at the beginning of the book. We're talking about the place known as Arvot Moav, the plains of Moav, which actually we can see from Jerusalem on a clear day. If you look to the east, it's in Jordan now, and that's where people were encamped, a little bit north of the line of Jerusalem, that when they crossed the Jordan with Yehoshua, the first city that they encountered was Jericho, Jericho. In any event, it was in this place that they arrived, Torah-wise, many sedras ago, at the end of Chukat, or Korach maybe, and that's where the people are. The last week's sedra gave the travelogue summary of all the places they had been to with a couple of incidences from the time they left Egypt until almost 40 years later to the threshold of the land of Israel, just on the east side of the Jordan River. The Torah also tells us in the beginning of Devarim when they arrived there, or rather when Moshe commenced the final series of lectures, we'll call them, to the people. It was the first day, Rosh Chodesh, of the 11th month, Shvat. Tradition tells us that Moshe Rabbeinu died on the 7th of Adar, in which case the book of Devarim takes place in one location, Arvot Moav, in the time span of 37 days, and the very end of the book tells us of the passing of Moshe Rabbeinu. The first part of Moshe Rabbeinu's farewell series of talks to the people involved brief review of the history of the last 40 years, and the particular episode that Moshe Rabbeinu emphasizes and focuses on is not the sin of the golden calf, or Korach's rebellion. Those are passed over at this point with a casual allusion, with a place name, to say these happened and we'll be talking about them. But the one that he focuses on is the sin of the spies. Original accounting is in the weekly reading of Shlach, but it is here in the beginning of the book of Devarim, in Parshat Devarim, that Moshe Rabbeinu gives his personal accounting of what happened with the Meraglim. This is significant, being right before Tisha B'Av, in fact, the day before this year, in that the Mishnah tells us that there were five tragedies that are marked by Tisha B'Av, the first one being the decree against the adult male population of the generation of the wilderness that they would not enter Eretz Yisrael, but would die out in a period of 40 years of wandering, 1 year for each day of the 40-day sojourn and scouting mission in the land of Canaan. In our national period of mourning, be it the entire three-week period from the 17th of Tammuz to the 9th of Av, it's really a half a day longer because we hold the mournful practices of the 9 days to the 10th of Av as well, to midday, and the more intense period, which we call the 9 days, from Rosh Chodesh Av until, as I said, the middle of the 10th day of Av. 9 days is almost a misnomer in that case. Mourning the destruction of the temples, first Beit HaMikdash, second Beit HaMikdash, involves also mourning the tragedy of the sin of the spies, and in all of those cases involves or must involve more than mourning. Mourning is woe unto us, look what happened in the past. The more is look at why things happened in the past. Look at the traditional answers to the question, why was the first Beit HaMikdash destroyed? Why were the people exiled? Why was the second Beit HaMikdash destroyed? Why were the people exiled? Why has the second exile continued for so many, many long years? And why was there such a thing as the sin of the spies? It's all rolled into one. Tisha B'Av gets its character, its kickstart, from the episode of the spies. That's the significance, I believe, of looking into the Parsha of Devarim and seeing what goes on there. But what it does is create an agenda that says mourning, M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G, is important, but it is not just a reflection of the past. It is a way of embarking on a tikkun, a repair of the causes of destruction, so that we will be privileged to see the rebuilding of the Beit HaMikdash when there is no longer any purpose to maintain it in its destroyed state. I take the well-known statement in the Talmud of any generation in whose time the Beit HaMikdash is not rebuilt, it is as if it is destroyed during that generation. What does that mean? Well, if Chet HaMeraglim, the sin of the spies, is one of the inputs as to in the whole scene of Churban, then if the conditions of the sin of the spies still exists in our time, then only for the fact that the Beit HaMikdash was already destroyed, if it hadn't been destroyed, it would have been destroyed in our time, because we still have those things that contribute to its destruction. And certainly being unfaithful to God, and not necessarily in the more Tanakhi, biblical sense of pure idol worship, but there are other ways that people turn away from God or cheat on God or betray God, and that's part of the destruction process. And the unfaithfulness to the land of Israel in the form of the mitzvot that should have been kept and weren't, these are things that still exist in our own time. And the gratuitous hatred of Jew to his fellow Jew, sinat chinam, which is that which is pointed to as the major cause of the destruction of the second temple, the second Beit HaMikdash. If that exists in our own time, it is part of the reason that the Beit HaMikdash has not been rebuilt. Therefore, we can say it harshly that in our generation, where the temple has not yet been rebuilt, it's as if it was destroyed in our time. But this opens up a very hopeful avenue of thought. Because if it is so, that conditions that would lead to the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash exist in our time, and that's why it's not yet being rebuilt, then we've got a great idea. Let us erase those conditions, reverse those conditions, and when those conditions no longer exist in our own time, then the next natural step is the building of the third Beit HaMikdash, the coming of Mashiach, and the end of so many long years of exile with the Geula Shlema, the complete redemption. So, we got a simple agenda here. If Chet HaMeraglim was part of that process, and I believe it was, it set the tone for Tisha B'Av and what Tisha B'Av represents, then the plan is simply don't continue and perpetuate the sin of the spies. What does that mean? I'll boil it down. I've spoken about it much more intensely in the past, and I will continue to do it. I don't know if I'll do it so much at this particular point, but I will summarize it as follows. The Meraglim, 10 out of the 12 scouts that were sent into the land, came back, and what they in essence said, if I had to summarize it in one sentence, it would be, Land of Israel, a beautiful place to visit, but I wouldn't want to live there. Beautiful place to visit, it truly is a good land, a land flowing with milk and honey. Take a look at these fruits that we brought back. And it's a wonderful thing. But living there would be impossible for us, or too difficult for us. That panicked an entire generation, the adult male population, and resulted in the punishment and the decree that that generation would wander in the wilderness and die out. So on that point alone, ask yourself the question, what's the story now? 5,765, that's the year, 2005 according to the way they count. Do we have a situation where the words of Yehoshua and Kalev and Moshe and Aharon, who called the people to rally to the call to go into Eretz Yisrael as God wanted us, is that what we are hearing from the majority of the Jews of the world? Or are we hearing echoes of the 10 Meraglim who doomed that generation to wander over the 40-year period and die out, not stepping foot into Eretz Yisrael? If we hear that echoing today of Aliyah, what are you, crazy? Now, I've heard that in two contexts. One, I should go on Aliyah? What, am I crazy? Worse, I've heard, you're going on Aliyah? What, are you crazy? That which echoes in my head since I heard it from the lips of a very significant American Jew, North American Jew, a leader in the religious Zionists of America. What are you, out of your mind? Go to live in Israel? That is Chet HaMeraglim. If Chet HaMeraglim is the stronger situation today than the words of Kalev, Alo Na'ale. If this is what God wants us to do, then we will do it. If the Chet HaMeraglim still exists in our time, then you can't be surprised why we have Tisha B'Av still. We have Tisha B'Av as a sad, mournful day, as long as Chet HaMeraglim is alive and well. Same thing with unfaithfulness to God. Same thing with tearing down Torah and mitzvot. Same thing with sinat chinam. If we have sinat chinam, hatred of one group of Jews for another, then you can't wonder how come this exile from the destruction of the second Beit HaMikdash has continued till our time. Because every generation in whose time the Beit HaMikdash is not rebuilt, it's as if it was destroyed in that generation. We have to ask ourselves the question, do we have the elements that will cause the destruction of a Beit HaMikdash? Do we have those elements in our society? If the answer, sadly, is yes, then you can't be surprised why we don't have a Beit HaMikdash and why we have so many problems. If we get to the point, and that's my point, that each thinking and caring Jew must recommit himself to Torah and mitzvot, must take an active role not only in personal observance of the Torah, but of finding the right way to spread Torah observance, the values of Torah, the love of Torah, to our fellow Jews, to encourage Aliyah, to help facilitate Klita. We reach a point, in Yirtzeh Hashem, we will reach a point, and it could be sooner than later, that the majority of the Jews are caring, observant Jews, good people, helpful to each other, living in Eretz Yisrael, striving to live a life of Torah in Eretz Yisrael, with care and concern for all Jews. Then God could say, no reason to continue the Churban, Geula. You are listening to Torah Tidbits Audio on OU Radio. If you live in Israel, you might have access to the hard copy of Torah Tidbits. If you don't, and you do live in Israel, be in touch with us at the Israel Center. Best way would be to email us at tt@ou.org and say, I live in such and such a community. We don't get Torah Tidbits in our shul, and maybe we will arrange to have that done if possible. If you don't live in Israel, you have access to Torah Tidbits weekly on the OU website, www.ou.org. You could go through it by saying /Torah, T-O-R-A-H, /TT, and that'll bring you straight to the Torah Tidbits page, or you can go to the homepage of the OU website and click on Torah Tidbits wherever it exists. Then you're able to open whatever files you're interested in, download selectively. We have a PDF format. We have a format for the Palm Pilot. We have a printer-friendly format with the whole file of Torah Tidbits or the selected features. You can also receive a copy of the above by email each week. Send your request to tt@ou.org and say you want to subscribe, you want an email message, you want an attached text file, you want the graphics file, you want the POM file, or you want the PDF files, or any combination thereof. Once again, tt@ou.org for anything that you are interested in connected with Torah Tidbits or Torah Tidbits audio. I originally was not going to play any music this week, being so close to Tisha B'Av, but one of the tracks on that album for Music for the 3 Weeks comes from the Book of Eicha, a collection of psukim and phrases from the book, including some very, very powerful, tragic psukim. And even if the song is well done, the mood is certainly appropriate for Erev 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 Tisha B'Av. The track is simply called Eicha.
Dirachenu v'nachkoira v'noshuva ad Hashem. Al zeh hoyado v'libeinu aleile choshku eineinu. Yerushalayim, Ir HaKodesh, Kol Dor Sheloi Nimneh, Beis HaMikdash, Ve'yamav, Kilu, Necherav, Ve'yamav, Im Eshkochem.
Mentioned earlier the Kotel yesterday, there was a prayer vigil, we'll call it, that was called uncharacteristically by Sfardim and Ashkenazim, Charedim and religious Zionist. The overall flavor, when someone asked me what colors I saw, were black and orange, if you get that meaning. It was an amazing turnout. I don't know what the official estimates of the number of attendees, but let me ask you to picture it like this. The entire Kotel Plaza, we'll call it the prayer plaza up front, and the entire much larger Kotel Plaza all the way back to the flags and the police station, packed, all the stairs approaching the Kotel, filled with people. I was on the streets that went from Shar Yafo, Jaffa Gate, to the Kotel area, could not even get near the Kotel Plaza. Those streets, all the way through the Old City, were jam-packed with people. When people were told there's no way that they're going to get down to the Kotel Plaza, large groups of people just decided to daven where they were. And I'm not talking just about davening mincha, we're talking about the special tefillot which were given out in pamphlets for the occasion. And so however many thousands you had in the Kotel Plaza, here was another 100, here was another 150, here was another 200, here was another 10, all over the place. It took me and my daughter with me to go from the Cardo area in the Jewish quarter to the Jaffa Gate by foot about 45 minutes. That's how crowded it was with people. 45 minutes for a 5-minute walk. So you had that feeling of Jews who, many of whom no longer know what to do to show their opposition to the disengagement plan. And one thing the Jew always falls back on and relies on is prayer. And this was an amazing manifestation of Jews beseeching God that in some way or another the disengagement should not proceed. Let me talk about that for a moment. When I pray to God that the disengagement should not happen, I include a stipulation. I say to God that I don't want him to stop it anyway. I want him to stop it in such a way that will not bring harm or worse to the Jewish people. That's a tall order, because there are scenarios that one can imagine that would also result in the stopping or a postponement of disengagement, but you don't want those things to happen. So I want it, and I don't know how it's going to work, but what I pray for is that, A, it's a proper cause to pray that the hitnat kut, the disengagement, should not happen, and two, that it should be done in a way that won't hurt people. Maybe that's too much of a tall order, but if we're talking about praying to God, then there is no such thing as a tall order. Aside from being opposed to giving up pieces of Eretz Yisrael into the hands of our sworn enemy, which, by the way, should be enough to have most people opposed to it, which I won't understand how come there are people who don't oppose it on that ground alone. And aside from the fact that very significant military and political people in the know have said this is a terrible thing to do, they didn't say that it should never be done, which I hope that it will never be done, but they said at this point and in this way, it is something that will backfire on our face, will not save Jewish lives, and will not lead to peace. This disengagement is handing over to terrorists, a victory, where they will say, because they're already saying it, that our terror campaign against Israel has been successful, and we will continue it until it's more successful. And we will continue it until it's ultimately as successful as we want, which is everything. So on that basis alone, even if you don't want to include giving up parts of Eretz Yisrael, but I said even aside from that, there are immense problems which the government has not taken care of. The disengagement will displace 10,000 people from their homes. The government has not yet provided where these people are going to live. You cannot evict someone from his house, expel someone from his community, and not give him a place to live, let alone live as well as he's been living. You have the terrible psychological damage that will result, not that might result, that will result if this plan goes through. Yesterday's paper had an article about a big-shot psychologist who was very concerned with the psychological ramifications for the policemen and soldiers who will be doing the displacing. They face many, many potential problems, including insomnia and impotence and depression and all kind of bad things. And that's not even to mention the settlers themselves, the citizens themselves. In fact, I found it a little odd and maybe frustrating and infuriating that this should have been the concern. Oy, what are our policemen, Nebuch, the ones that are going to go in, beat people, and drag them out of their homes? You got to feel sorry for them because they face psychological damage. Can you imagine the enormity of the psychological and emotional problems that the people who live in Gush Katif, who don't want to be taken out of their homes, who don't want to see the graves of their loved ones exhumed to be reburied someplace else, that don't want to see or hear about shuls and schools and homes being destroyed? Imagine the psychological damage. And legally, an apparatus is supposed to be set up to cope with those psychological problems before you create them. And it's not being done. This disengagement plan is terrible. It is immoral. It is obscene. I have said that, and I will continue to say that, as a Jew, as a person, and yes, even as a person identified with the Israel Center, with the OU Israel Center. And even though when I write in Torah Tidbits, I say, I, Phil Chernovsky, not representing the OU, not representing the Israel Center, not representing Torah Tidbits, feel the following in order to get people to talk about it, get people to take a stand, and get people, hopefully, to do something about it. And I know there are people who disagree with me. So be it. And if what I am saying now, not only on Israel National Radio, which applauds what I'm saying, but on OU Radio, which probably gets nervous for what I'm saying, I will still say it again. The disengagement plan is obscene and immoral and will create, has already started to create, but will create horror and problems that no one is going to be able to make all right. And it has to be stopped. And it should not be stopped in a violent way. And it should not be stopped in a way that will hurt Jews and people. Therefore, it is God that I beseech to do what he can to stop this in the best possible way. And I'm certainly not going to refrain from saying that. Let me get back to Parshat Devarim. Aside from the Meraglim aspect, which to me plugs right into Tisha B'Av, there are two mitzvot that come within the context of part of what Moshe Rabbeinu was telling the people, namely that he got tired of handling the people on his own. That resulted in the Sanhedrin of 70 elders, together with Moshe 71 Sanhedrin. That, in turn, created the whole justice system. And there are two prohibitions. One is that one may not select judges for the Sanhedrins. That's plural, the great Sanhedrin, the smaller Sanhedrins of 23 in major towns and cities, and even the smaller Batei Din of 3 judges. Judges may not be selected except for the right reason. Someone who is well-versed in Torah, knowledge, as well as practice, and not because he's wealthy, because he's charismatic, because he's scary, because he threatened, or whatever. Of course, it's nice to have a charismatic person in that position, too, but it has to be the right criteria for judges. The other one is that a judge may not be afraid to render a decision. That's a tall order. don't want to go into the whole thing now, but I do want to say the following. These two mitzvot, and most of the other mitzvot in the Torah that are essentially directed and primarily directed towards the leadership of the people and towards the courts, really on certain levels apply to every Jew. We each might not be a formal judge sitting on a Sanhedrin, but we are all in the position to be judges. We are all in the position, one time or another, to appoint people in that position. And therefore the prohibition against appointing someone for the wrong reason applies not just to the leadership of the people when we're talking about filling a vacancy on the Supreme Court. We are talking about every individual who has in some way or another that role of voting yes or no on a potential youth director or the rabbi of a shul or a teacher in the school or a principal in the school, that you have to find the right person with the right credentials. And when a person is in that position, and again, we're all in position of judging as parents or as co-workers, employers, or whatever, that we can't be afraid to make a judgment. We can't be intimidated to make a judgment, whatever it is. And these are things that apply in a much broader sense to the whole population and not just those that are involved in setting up the judicial system or running it. Now back to Tisha B'Av. Let's review a couple of aspects of Shabbat, which is Erev Tisha B'Av. The way I like to think of it is that when Shabbat and Tisha B'Av clash, Shabbat wins. And that means if the ninth of Av falls on Shabbat, we don't fast on the ninth of Av. We postpone the fast to the tenth. But when Tisha B'Av follows Shabbat, either because it's been postponed from Shabbat, or like this year, because it falls on Saturday night, Sunday in the first place, even though Shabbat trumps Tisha B'Av, Tisha B'Av gets a few licks in. We do not have the Su'udat HaMafseket, the meager mourner's meal of an egg dipped in ash, a crusty piece of bread, and a glass of water. We have a full Su'uda Shlishit, Shalashudas, right before Tisha B'Av begins. And yet, there are restrictions. Most people hold there are no restrictions as far as menu is concerned, even to the point where you're allowed to eat meat and drink wine, and some restrict it to what you would usually eat at a Su'uda Shlishit, but there are other restrictions. We have to stop eating, for example, and drinking before sunset and not extend our Su'uda Shlishit further than that. And that means paying attention to the clock. Here in Jerusalem, we're talking about a sunset at 7:25, which means a couple of minutes before that, we finish Su'uda Shlishit. For the remainder of Shabbat, till about 8:05, so we're talking another 40 minutes, we're not allowed to eat or drink, not allowed to wash, not allowed to use lotions and cosmetics, but we are allowed to continue wearing leather shoes, since removing them on Shabbat would be a public display of mourning on Shabbat, which is not proper. And we are allowed to sit on a regular chair, even though, had this been during the week, at sunset, that prohibition would kick in as well. Tisha B'Av knocks out Havdalah, almost, right after the termination of Shabbat. We either daven Ma'ariv, which includes a passage of Havdalah, which we have every Friday, every Motzoi Shabbat, but no Havdalah with a cup of wine yet. And we do say a bracha on a Havdalah candle, Borei Miorei Ha'esh. We do not take Besamim. After the fast of Tisha B'Av, we say Havdalah with a cup of wine and the bracha Hamavdil, but we don't say the Besamim bracha, nor on Sunday night do we say the fire bracha, which belongs only on Motzoi Shabbat, and we have said it anyway. Interesting side point, although for some people it won't be a side point, a person who is going to eat on Tisha B'Av for health reasons, many people hold they're supposed to make Havdalah before they eat. The reason that we hold Havdalah till Sunday night is because the average person fasts the whole day, and the restriction of eating before Havdalah doesn't apply until after the fast. But if a person is going to eat at 10 o'clock in the morning or at 10 o'clock the night before, it has to be begun with Havdalah, in which case it shouldn't be wine, which is not appropriate for Tisha B'Av, although some say you can make Havdalah with wine and give it to a child to drink. There the preference is a child who really doesn't understand Avelut HaChurban, but one who is old enough to understand the concept of making a bracha. The child can't be too young, because if he doesn't really understand brachot, it does not solve the problem of a bracha followed by someone drinking. It has to be someone who understands the concept of making a bracha. In which case, a substitute for wine would be preferable, like apple juice or any of the other approved, what's known as chamar medina. But just focus on the idea that Havdalah needs to be said. I even saw in a sefer that if one is fasting but hears Havdalah from the lips of someone who is eating on Tisha B'Av, then that person does not need to say Havdalah that night. Because once you hear Havdalah, you hear Havdalah. Obviously, it has to be a kosher, legitimate Havdalah, which it would be in the case of a person who is halachically permitted and even required to eat. There is an aspect of Tisha B'Av that I think is heightened and focused on in our current situation that I wanted to relate to. It might sound a little flippant, but please hear me through. The way our sages orchestrated the mourning of the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash is similar to the way we do a yo-yo. I mean by that, for those who know how to use a yo-yo, that what you have to do is jerk back on the string a moment, a fraction of a second, before the yo-yo hits its bottom. When it's extended fully, it's too late almost then to draw it back. Then it stays extended. But if you give that instinctive jerk at the right moment before the yo-yo is completely strung out, then it will return nicely to your hand. Starting at Shivasar B'Tammuz and the beginning of the 3 weeks is a mild form of mournful practices. They intensify during the 9 days from Rosh Chodesh Av. They intensify furthermore during the week in which Tisha B'Av falls, which this year we don't have. They intensify on Erev Tisha B'Av, but this year that's Shabbat, so it's not going to be as obvious. And of course, they intensify on Tisha B'Av itself. If the mournful practices have done their job properly, then we should be sufficiently aware of the seriousness of the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, and we should be sad, maybe even depressed, but not that that should be how we remain. Comes the afternoon of Tisha B'Av with a slight relaxing of the intense, mournful practices. You're still not allowed to eat and drink or bathe or use lotions and cosmetics. All of that is still forbidden. But the shul looks like a shul again. The lighting is up to full. The coverings are back on the ark and the table. The talis and tefillin are worn at mincha. Birchat Kohanim is done at mincha. And most significantly, we take on Nachem, the Nechama aspect of Tisha B'Av begins already in the afternoon of Tisha B'Av. It will continue afterwards, and hopefully we will see that light at the end of the tunnel, both in historic perspective as well as the particular plight of this impending disengagement plan. Hello? May we see the Geula in our time. Shabbat Shalom, a meaningful fast, and L'Geula Shlema, L'Hishtameya.
La 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 la.
ani boy khiyo alele ani boy khiyo
Shiva shofetayich kivari shona v'yoatzayich kevatechila acharechein yikore lach yir hatzedek kirya ne'emona Tzion b'mishpat tipada v'shaveha b'tzedakah.